This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Instead of Bing Crosby's Christmas album, we're going to have impeachment.
Yes, as former acting attorney general Matt Whitaker observed Thursday on Fox, it's beginning to look a lot like impeachment. Perhaps just in time for the holidays, when treetops glisten and children listen to hear accusations of bribery, obstruction, and abuse of presidential power.
With confidence and humility, with allegiance to our founders, and a heart full of love for America, today I am asking our chairman to proceed with articles of impeachment.
In finally giving her green light, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi rejected Republican accusations of political vendetta and couched the decision as constitutional duty. This setting the stage for what? For exactly the absurd spectacle we've experienced literally from day one of Trump's presidency. Documented facts against a vaudeville of denial. So, here we are again, after 3 years facing one of the more memorable Yuletides ever, and we have in all that time advanced the story, impeachment or no impeachment, not one Christmas fig. Professor Carlin of Stanford, a witness handpicked by Democrats to debunk Republican accusations of unfairness, lack of due process, sham, and coup d'etat, was no nonsense about this.
What has happened in the case today is something that I do not think we have ever seen before. A president who has doubled down on violating his oath to faithfully execute the laws and to protect and defend the Constitution.
But not so fast. It may seem like Trump's flouting of Congress is singular, that his governing by executive fiat is unprecedented, but nope. Been there, impeached that. In 1868, the House of Representatives voted for articles of impeachment against President Andrew Johnson. As a U.S. Senator and Vice President under Abraham Lincoln, Johnson had fought hard against secession and revered the Constitution. But installed in the presidency after Lincoln's assassination, he thwarted congressional plans for Reconstruction. His reason? Congress had declined to immediately offer the 11 former Confederate states their former seats without concessions, such as the right of suffrage for freed blacks. Thus, Johnson concluded, the legislative branch was illegitimate. The incomplete Congress could pass no laws, and he proceeded to do whatever he could to return freed slaves in the South to an existence of utter degradation. Brenda Wineapple is the author of The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson and the Dream of a Just Nation. She says that after Lincoln died, Congress was out of session. Johnson refused to call a special session and instead began acting on his own.
He started putting into place executive actions in the South that would reconstruct the governments along Southern white supremacist lines, prevented the formerly enslaved people from making contracts, from moving, from marrying, from any kind of due process. When Congress got back into session, first they passed a civil rights law. Johnson vetoed it. Congress passed the legislation over his vetoes, and then they started the Reconstruction laws to put the formerly seceded states back into Congress by getting them to redo their constitutions, to make sure that black men had the vote, and also to ratify the 14th Amendment, because by this time, Congress had decided due process should be enshrined in the Constitution. They also passed the Tenure of Office Act. The Tenure of Office Act said that cabinet members who have been approved by the Senate cannot be fired unless the Senate approves that too. The reason they passed that particular law was to protect a specific cabinet member, Edwin Stanton, who was the Secretary of War. The military had been kept in the South to make sure that black men and white loyalists were able to get to the polls.
There were generals who were appointed essentially as viceroys,
who had fought to protect the Union, and now they see people slaughtered on the streets. So they were there to prevent this kind of violence. Johnson fired Edwin Stanton. And because Johnson had violated a specific law, the House of Representatives felt that it had no choice but to vote overwhelmingly to impeach Andrew Johnson. That happened in February of 1868.
I want to ask you about Johnson's motives in his authoritarianism. One is that he wanted to rebuild the Union as quickly as possible. The other is that he was just a naked white supremacist. Which of those do you think best describes his motives?
He did want the Union reconstructed as quickly as possible, but he said, this is a white man's country, and by God, it will be a white man's government. Johnson was born in North Carolina, as poor white as you could possibly be. His mother sent him and his brother out as indentured servants. And when he ran away from the tailor shop where he was indentured, the owner of the shop put out a wanted sign as if Johnson were a fugitive slave. He's not a planter. He's not part of the Southern aristocracy. But it does not mean that he doesn't really, at some level, want to be part of them. So when he gets into the White House, he begins pardoning those aristocrats who served in the Confederate Army or in the Confederate government, almost 100 a day. He becomes quite authoritarian. He loves the Union, but he also loves the power of white people over everyone else.
It's not just some political squabble mm-hmm. that we're discussing here.
Right.
There were black Americans shot in the street for the crime of being black.
Right. In both Memphis in the spring of 1866 and then in New Orleans that summer, black men and women were slaughtered on the streets. Women were raped. Beatings and whippings in both cases. Concerted mob violence that began to be understood as the formation of the Ku Klux Klan, which people in the Democratic press or the white supremacist press dismissed as propaganda. There were constant reports of this by journalists who traveled south, by the military, and actually Congress convened a committee that took testimony. 144 people testified about what was going on in the South, and it was dismissed by Johnson.
Thanks to the Telegraph,
yeah.
There was a lively daily press already developed in 1868. But almost every paper was affiliated with a party or a faction of a party.
That's absolutely right.
Was it like every outlet was Fox News spinning the narrative to suit its own constituency?
Well, there was MSNBC, too. but yes, all the press was partisan. But you had some really wonderful journalists, and the most surprising one was Mark Twain. And early on in the impeachment trial was actually covering it, caustic and as insightful as anyone that you wanted to meet or read.
I made a little joke about Fox News, but were any of the major papers at the time so partisan as to utterly distort the actual straight dope in order to support its audience's worldview?
You had a lot of speculation. You had a lot of propaganda. The New York World gave me the chills because it was so incredibly racist. But that doesn't mean they were making up things. The scary thing to me is that this kind of propaganda sometimes hardens and
it calcifies into history.
Yes. And in fact, the calcification of history, I can give you a good example, John Kennedy's Profiles in Courage, which got a Pulitzer Prize. One of the chapters claims that a man named Edmund Ross, junior senator from Kansas, was himself courageous, heroic for casting the vote that kept Andrew Johnson in office. Andrew Johnson, it said, should never have been impeached. It was the radical, fanatic, maniacal Republicans who wanted him out of office. And you can still sort of hear some of that point of view today. Kennedy writes, there was no real reason for Johnson to be impeached. The issues were not national issues. You look back and you say, how can you say that? Well, if you read Ross's memoir, that's what he's going to say because he's justifying his vote.
The deciding vote, rather than being a profile in courage, may have been a profile in bribery. What's the historical evidence?
Well, there's quite a bit of historical evidence. Edmund Ross, the junior senator from Kansas, he kept going to Johnson, and there are letters where he says, for my vote, would you please take care of, say, my father-in-law, my brother, myself? Johnson would do whatever he asked, and then Ross would come back for another favor. Sorry to have to come back, but for my vote. And so,
holy for my vote.
Yeah.
The nation was only 79 years into the life of the Constitution.
Amazing.
But even then, they had to deal with the murky language of the framers, as in, what the hell are high crimes
right.
and misdemeanors?
Right.
So for guidance, they turned to Alexander Hamilton.
And we do the same thing today. In Federalist 65, Hamilton said that a civil officer, particularly a president, could be impeached for something called maladministration and abuse of the public trust. Now, that doesn't make things very clear, but it was actually pretty smart not to be so specific because the kinds of maladministration or misbehavior or abuse is going to change over time. Unfortunately, what's elastic is also kind of murky at the same time.
So how did the House determine that Johnson crossed the line into political crime?
People were so offended by his bigotry, by saying Congress was illegitimate and couldn't pass any laws because those 11 states weren't seated in it. There were some who were so horrified by that that they wanted to impeach Johnson as early as 1867. The issues went to the Judiciary Committee. We've heard of that. But they were waiting for a specific violation of law because of these very murky issues about what's abuse of power. By the time that they actually voted overwhelmingly, as I said, to impeach Andrew Johnson, they voted because of the tripwire, the violating of the Tenure of Office Act.
So firing Stanton was the, hey, would you do me a favor, perfect phone call.
Exactly. It was the straw that broke the camel's back. It was the perfect phone call. You know, it was considered so egregious. And it didn't take very long for the House to drop those articles of impeachment. There were 11, 9 of which dealt with the violation of the tenure of office.
All right. Now, spoiler alert. Andrew Johnson was acquitted in his Senate trial by one very questionable vote. Was it mostly along partisan lines?
Mostly, but not entirely. There were 7 Republicans who voted along with the Democrats to keep Johnson in office. What happened was that you were very close to an election. The Republicans had Ulysses S. Grant, the popular war hero, waiting in the wings. They wanted to nominate him. And they were afraid that if Benjamin Wade, considered a radical Republican, were to take Johnson's office, even for a short amount of time, that would somehow undermine Ulysses S. Grant, and Grant might even have to put Wade on the ticket with him. But there were other reasons, too. Something that we would call dark money today was floating around. There was a House investigation of what was going on, favors being passed back and forth and promises made. By and large, however, the impeachment was a partisan process.
This all played out, familiarly enough, as Johnson was readying himself for a re-election campaign. Was there consideration in the House about just letting electoral politics take their natural course?
No. The House felt it had no choice but to go forward with impeachment. I mean, it had been dragging its feet, but when Johnson violated the law, they just said, that's enough. The Senate is a different story. It's a higher bar for removal from office. It's not a simple majority. It's two-thirds.
Now, I happen to know of a president facing impeachment who responds by refusing to cooperate with congressional subpoenas and with vicious ad hominem attacks on all of his perceived enemies, including members of his own administration. How did Andrew Johnson respond to the process?
He wanted to take his case to the people. He was a demagogue, stirring up crowds and actually calling, believe it or not, for the execution of his perceived enemies, particularly men in Congress. So he was as epithet-strewing as anyone you might think of in the present.
Oh, and I might add, he didn't need his Secretary of Energy to compare him to Jesus Christ. He just took care of that himself.
Well, he told black people that he was going to be their Moses. Oh, God. He thought of himself as deeply persecuted, too.
Johnson was acquitted, and then came the election. But it's not as though he lost in a general election to Ulysses S. Grant. He never got to a general election.
No, the Democrats felt that he was toxic. They had had enough of Andrew Johnson.
Not quite enough.
No.
His political career did not end.
No. He was not a broken man. He was an angry man. And in the 1870s, Andrew Johnson is sent back by the Tennessee legislature to the United States Senate. And what does he do? He stands up and he goes on a rant against Ulysses S. Grant. During congressional recess, Andrew Johnson goes home and passes away before he can do any more damage in the Senate.
Throughout this conversation, I've been pointing out parallels, some of them actually quite eerie, to 150 years ago and today. What lessons should we take from the Johnson impeachment?
Having 9 articles of impeachment focused on the violation of a law and only 2 on abuse of power and obstruction of justice means that people forgot that the real issues at stake were not the question of this particular law, maybe even this particular phone call, if you want to make that kind of analogy, but actually the direction that the country should and would go in. Today, what's at stake, too, is the direction of the country, that really what's behind the abuse of power is the destruction of a whole democratic structure and the independence of a sovereign country. And the fact in both cases that no one, not even a chief executive, is above the law.
Brenda, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. A pleasure.
Historian Brenda Wineapple is the author of The Impeachers.
Coming up, a map for navigating the nation's roiling political right.
This is On the Media.